Sweet Spot listeners, we have an incredible deal on a new product from one of our favorite companies, ShotScope. You know that if you listen to this show, Adam and I are big on strategy and tracking stats like strokes gained. ShotScope has just released their new V5 GPS watch. There are tons of upgrades like full color maps of each hole, GPS distances to hazards, layup points, and doglegs, and more importantly, dynamic yardages to the front, middle, and back of every green. You're also going to get 16 of their second generation shot tracking tags that will automatically track all of your shots. That way, you're going to get access to over 100 statistics on their online portal, and you'll be able to see your strokes gained and handicap benchmarking against other golfers. So if you want to make a plan to improve, you can clearly see which part of your game needs the most help, and more importantly, the whys. The best part about ShotScope is that there are no ongoing fees for using their stat tracking portal. So now for our deal. We are giving Sweet Spot listeners in the US and Canada a $70 discount. Yes, you heard that correctly. That brings the price of the watch down to $179.99. All you have to do is go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT, that's one word, at checkout. Once again, go to ShotScope.com, add the V5 GPS watch to your cart, and use promo code SWEETSPOT for your $70 discount.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from Practical Golf. And as always, I'm joined by
Adam from Adamian Golf. I was looking for my name. Normally, there's my name up there. So I just zone out and I just read it. So I'm like, who am I again?
We're going to go straight to the existential crisis. Like, who am I? It's like that scene in Zoolander. Who am I? Well, now that Adam has identified himself, we can move on with the beginning of the episode. So we got a little bit of a two-parter. The first part, which I'm excited. This is the official announcement / release of my new book, The Foundations of Winning Golf. A guide to competition for players of all levels. So we don't have any music on this show, but I guess
thinking the exact same tone, and that doesn't even
you're gonna do
fit?
that too. Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good one. So there marks the release of my next book.
Congratulations.
I'm excited. Thank you. Yeah, it feels so, you know what this feels like when you work on something, you put it out into the world.
Yeah,
it was a long time for you. I'm encouraging you to write another book. But I think we have people who listen to the show who are writers and have put work out into the world. And we were talking about this before we hit the record button. It's a mixture of excitement and a little bit of anxiety and dread, because you're excited that I worked on this for a long time. I think I've written something of value. I hope people will enjoy it and it'll help their golf games. But at the same time, yeah, I'm a little nervous to see how people react to it, like I was when I released my last book. So it's cool to do something like that. I always encourage people, like, even if you don't release it to the world, like doing some type of project like that, whether it's writing a book or something, like, I think it has personal value. It's a nice thing to do.
Yeah, my practice manual that I wrote, that I had no idea what would become of it, honestly. When I wrote it, it was literally to put on my CV. What do you call it? A resume in America.
Resume here, yes.
Yeah, just to say published author. I thought I might sell 100 copies or something like that, but yeah.
And now look at it.
Yeah, still going 10 years later.
You got to write another one.
Uh-huh, I know. I got another 10 in me, but I'm just trying to extend out my career.
Well, I'm going to be the guinea pig for this model, because I'm going to keep, my goal is, I might have said this in other episodes, but I didn't think I wanted to write another book after The Four Foundations of Golf came out, because it took so much out of me. But I think I'm interested in making it a series, an ongoing series, and I'm just going to try and keep tackling different topics. And hopefully in a decade or two, I'll have a nice body of work that golfers will enjoy, they'll find value in, and I'll be proud that I contributed something to the golf world. So that's my goal. And we'll see. So this next book is kind of an experiment to see how it goes.
Yeah. I've had lots of projects that have failed as well, but it's good when one of them hits and people enjoy it. It's just got to keep testing. And
I've got a long list of failures. Long list.
When is it coming out?
It should be out. If this podcast is published, it is available on Amazon, like my other book and the practice manual in all markets. So whether you're on like Amazon US, Canada, UK, Australia, Germany, Spain, whatever, I click a publish button and you can order the Kindle paperback or hardback edition and they will send it to you wherever you are in the world. So Amazon is the primary method to get it. I will tackle this question now. Most people want to listen to audiobooks, and I did not release the audiobook immediately, kind of like the Four Foundations. I will release an audiobook, but it'll probably be a few months down the road. I will get to that, but I prefer to release the digital and hard copy editions first before I get to the audiobook. That's just how I've done things.
So what's it about then, without giving away all of the juice?
So this is a book about competition, and anyone who's listened to the show for a while knows that I like to compete. I am not a ultra competitor, but I'm what I'd call maybe a blossoming mid-amateur career. And I think most golfers love to compete. Like when I took up the game when I was 12, I put this in the book. Me and my buddies were like gambling our allowance money on like putting competitions on the green. So I think most golfers take up the game because they're competitive in nature. And when they do get involved in golf, they love playing matches with their friends. So this book is really for everyone who wants to compete, whether that is match play and gambling games against your friends, club competitions, which I know take on various formats throughout the world. I know in the UK, like the club competition scene is a bit stronger, and I'm kind of envious of that than it is in the US. But obviously, people belong to golf clubs here and they have club championships and all different types of events. So that style of competition as well. Or if you're a junior golfer or an adult golfer who is playing in more tournament style, more serious competition. So I tried to write something that would appeal to all levels of competition because I think the mindset should be fairly similar. I don't think it's all that different. Like the conversations I have with Mackenzie Hughes and him trying to win on the PGA Tour and play well really aren't all, they're different in some instances, but like it's not that much different to even someone who's like, hey, I'm looking to qualify for my first big event or win a club championship. The same stuff shows up in our heads, and I think a similar mindset needs to emerge. So yeah, this is a general guide to competition is the best way I can put it.
Yeah, you could be just as nervous playing your first ever competition, or even your first time on the golf course as, you know, a PGA Tour player going into his final round for a major might be, you know, might have similar nerves and similar things going on in your head, even though obviously one is more, in the absolute sense, a great deal, but to your own level, it's all relative, right?
Yeah, and I would also put in that this is my sales pitch, even if you have no intentions of competing, like I still think everything I've put in the book will help your golf game. And as a side note, as a sales pitch, you know, Adam and I try not to be too salesy on this show, but we never did anything like Patreons. I know our friends at Chasing Scratch have a Patreon group where you can kind of support them. And I think that works for their community. But people always ask, like, how can I support you guys? And the best way you can support us, which helps us to keep the show going and giving away a ton of free info, is, yeah, if you buy our books, Adam's Practice Manual, Four Foundations of Golf, this new one, Adam's Digital Products, or my video course, that's how you keep us going as, you know, I guess we're called creators now. We're not influencers anymore. That word changed. But it means a lot that all the listeners around the world support us, buy the products, leave reviews on Amazon that helps other golfers find them. So yeah, we try and give you as much value as possible in these episodes for free. Obviously, we have some advertisements to help supplement this. But yeah, that's why we always appreciate people kind of, that's our Patreon, is if you purchase our products from us, it helps us out tremendously.
Exactly, yeah. That's one of the main reasons that we do this, a little bit selfishly, but I think we'd probably do it even if we didn't have anything off the back end of it, but we just enjoy chatting about golf.
Yeah, we love golf. We enjoy talking about it. We love helping people with golf, but yeah, this is our
to be fully honest with everyone, like, you and me don't have other jobs. We have no other businesses. Like, this is our business, giving golf advice. So yeah, that's how you can be our Patreons, and we definitely appreciate it.
So John, in the book, what kind of chapters do you have, or what kind of topics are you talking about in particular? Obviously, the main theme of it is competition, but can you divulge a little bit more?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is peeling back the layers of what you can expect when you compete. I think a lot of people go out with the wrong mindset and they only think about performance and they're not there to learn. So I'm trying to shift people's mindset for how they approach competition in general. And a lot of it is being humble to the experience that's required, the level of introspection that's required, how you even think about winning in general. Like, I wrote the title is The Foundations of Winning Golf. And it's kind of a double entendre because obviously I want people to win in a literal sense. So how do we win in golf? We win matches, we win, you know, money from our friends, we win a club competition, we win a tournament, we win a qualifier. But as you get better and the competition increases, your chances to win in a literal sense decrease. It just becomes harder. You know, if you're in a field with 150 golfers, it's pretty hard to win. And if that's the only thing that's driving you and you don't find other ways to win, then you're never going to learn. You're never going to enjoy yourself. So a lot of the book is helping you find other ways to win with goal setting, a lot of internal goals, and really viewing it. I think a lot of the book is kind of part self-helpy because it's a great personal, like, development journey. Like, I think I'm a better person, like a better dad, a better husband, a better entrepreneur because I play competitive golf. Like, it's really been an amazing thing in my life, the community, the challenges I've faced, and a lot of that stuff. So there's a lot of this stuff in the book, mindset stuff, how to deal with nerves, how to set goals, how to deal with, like, playing partners you don't like, how do you approach a stroke play tournament versus a match play tournament. So I try and use my 15 plus years of experience competing and everything I've learned, all the mistakes I've made, everything I've witnessed from other golfers. Working with Matt Hughes has been incredibly important too, just understanding his mindset at the highest level and how I'm helping him. He's currently reading the book as well, and he's enjoying it, and it's helping him a bit. So yeah, it's a lot of different stuff, but I think it's, if I had to describe it, it's more of like a general philosophy and mindset that I'm trying to give people.
Why did you write it? Why do you choose this as a topic instead of swing mechanics or something?
Well, I don't think a lot of this information has been shared. And I'm not saying that no one has ever discussed competitive golf before or written books about it. I know they're out there, but I don't think it's something that, similar to when I started writing about, you know, expectation management and all the other topics I do, I didn't see a lot of it out there. And I know a lot of golfers are competing. And what I found was that a lot of the best competitors, they kind of hang on to their secrets a bit. So they don't really tell people what their mindset is or what they're learning. And also, just because you're good at competing doesn't mean you're good at coaching. Those are two separate skills. So, you know, sometimes you get sound bites from PGA Tour players. And they're like, oh, what does it mean to, like, play well in a tournament? And they're like, oh, they'll say the same platitudes and then not much else. So I wanted to give my version of, as a coach, being like, how can I get you from point A to point B and all the stuff you're going to deal with and give you tangible advice on how to get there? Because I just want the information out there, or at least my version of it. You know, nothing I say is, like, truly groundbreaking or different. I think it's just my style and how I say it. So yeah, I just think that I want the perspective out there. And I found that whenever I discussed, whether it was on the show or on Twitter, all the stuff that was going through my head, like when I went to the US Mid-Am or when I was trying to win a club championship or the other tournaments I play in, every time I shared that info, people are like, wow, this is great. Like, this is exactly the crazy crap that's going through my head. So I use that feedback. And a lot of the book is questions that I've received. So I'm answering a lot of questions and pain points that people have come to me with. So yeah, I think in a general sense, I just wanted to put out a work that discusses competition because I'm not sure there's a ton of it out there. I think I just kind of wanted to put my stake in the ground and be like, hey, this is my version of it. Hopefully it helps you.
So you mentioned that the title of the book has a kind of double meaning. So what is the definition of winning?
I think it has multiple meanings. Like, you can win. So winning is interesting because it's kind of like in life where if you're just out there to make money and have external results, and that's all you're playing for or going for, like eventually it can kind of, you know, the moments kind of come and go. And if there isn't something like beneath that, like a different set of competitive desires or goals you're trying to win, then I think you won't perform as well. And also, like, when you get to those external accolades, they're not as impactful and they kind of come and go. So I try and answer the question in multiple ways, saying, well, you go out there and you might not play well, but you could still win on that day if you stuck with all of the things you're holding yourself accountable to. Those could be mental things, strategic things, just stuff you're working on. And you could feel good about that. Like, this is really the crux of my conversations with Mackenzie, because every week he goes out there, he's not going to play well sometimes. So we have to make sure that if he's checking off the boxes that we're putting there for him and he's feeling good about that, you know, then he's not going to beat himself up as much. And I think that's what competitive golf does to a lot of people, is that because we're so focused on the external goals of winning, because that's fun and it's great, sometimes we get so trapped in that, that there's nothing else driving us and it just becomes too much. Like, every 8-footer we have, if we're only thinking about winning, then it's just like, well, I'm going to be a bit more nervous because I'm thinking about results too much. I think the one thing I would hope everyone gets out of the book is that how they can have a little bit more satisfaction in the process and being prideful of the fact that they're putting their game on the line. I think you can learn a lot when you compete, and it kind of makes the rest of your rounds a little less daunting, and there's some experience gain there. So yeah, and I think you can win in life by playing competitively as well, like all the lessons you learn. So I try and explore all of that. It's not just one thing. I think it's many things you can win at.
Yeah, I always try to take something from every round. And usually for me, it was a case of, I don't want to say grit, because I know we've had conversations about that in the past, but yeah, not giving up really, because we see it all the time, right? And everybody here is guilty of it, where you're playing not great, and then, you know, those 3-footers, 4-footers, instead of lining them up, you just go and tap it in instead because you're not paying attention to it, because you don't want, I think it's a case of, you don't want to have to go through the rigmarole of lining it up and then missing it and knowing that I really tried for that and I failed, you know. So it's almost like a safety mechanism. If I just nonchalantly go up and tap this and I miss it, then I can just blame the fact that I wasn't paying attention. So it's almost like a defense mechanism, really. And so, yeah, I would try to play rounds and make sure that that wouldn't happen. Or I even get it in sim golf now when I'm playing. I'll hit a couple of bad shots and then the next few, because you don't have that long walk in between with sim golf. And the next few, I can get a little frustrated and then get careless for the next one. Or I'll just grab my 8-iron and try and blast it as far as a 7-iron for the next one to get that anger out. And so it's like controlling yourself mentally. These are things I find hard to do, but yeah, those are goals that I try to achieve in my own game.
There's something special that happens, and you know, I talk a lot about the competition within. Like, I think that's the most compelling one. It's like the competition against myself. And when you go out there and, you know, when things are going well, obviously that's nice. And you know, sometimes you worry, oh, is the other shoe going to drop? Am I going to screw this up? And I have some methods of dealing with that. But I think on the days where you're struggling and it's hard and you kind of just want to be like, this sucks, I want to get out of here, and you kind of dig in and you find something and you learn something, that to me is a huge win, because now you're going up against kind of like your anger, your frustrations, your impatience. These are all things that I have to deal with on the course. Like, I feel like all my flaws are showing up on the golf course. And when I can kind of dig my heels in and stay through it, even if the score doesn't show it, that I know I didn't give up and I stayed engaged, I feel good about that. And that's a good habit to bring to future rounds. So that to me is a big win. And that's how you win tournaments and matches also, by having that mindset. That will lead to more literal wins in the long term. So yeah, that is part of the mindset, I think. So yeah, there's a lot of different things in the book. It's not nearly as long as the Four Foundations. I think the Four Foundations is 420 pages, which is monstrous, kind of like your book, Adam. This one's about half the length, maybe even less. So you can probably read this in a day or two. So it's a lot lighter to get through, I will tell people.
Do you have a favorite part of the book?
I have some personal stories in there, you know, stuff I've gone through. So I love the anecdotal stuff. I really enjoy talking about a lot of the philosophical things as well. You know that from being on the show with me, taking responsibility for things, some of the mental techniques I discuss would show up on the show, goal setting. So yeah, I think I enjoy all of them equally, but a lot of it is similar to my work on like expectation management. I think that's what most people love from me. If people like wrote a good review about the four foundations, it's usually about the expectation management part of the book. And this is kind of more of that. It's more of like that type of stuff in addition to like mental game stuff. So that's how it's different than the four foundations. This is a little bit less of a
question.
Yeah, I'll jump the gun here. It's a little bit less of a how-to book in the sense that like four foundations had a lot of practice stuff and strategy stuff in there. As I said, this is more of like a mindset and philosophy book. I do get into like nitty gritty of like, I think you should do this, this, and this, but it's more of like getting you to be in the proper state to compete and be out there to learn and not be so hard on yourself and deal with all the emotions that arise. So I tell a lot of, again, anecdotal stories, you know, stuff I've witnessed in other players, and just giving you a toolkit that you can use, whether, again, it might be a Saturday morning match against your friends that you're amped up for and you're nervous, could be trying to win your flight in the club championship. You might be an aspiring professional, and I think this book can help you. So yeah, it's definitely more my expectation management type stuff. So that's it. I'll end my sales pitch there. I would, again, everyone who listens to this show, you kind of came out in hordes and bought the last one and left reviews, and I know you're getting Adam's book, so it's much appreciated. My deal with anyone is like, I've injected as much value as possible into this book, and if you give me money, I want to give you something good in return. And I think I've done that again, but I'll leave that up for people to decide.
We are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back.
When you're hiring for your small business, like I have to, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to find the right professionals for your team faster and free. And you can always support us by checking them out at linkedin.com/sweetspot. LinkedIn is not just another job board. It is a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. I know a ton of people who are using it for multiple reasons, and LinkedIn has absolutely exploded over the last few years. There's wonderful content on business ideas, but more importantly, it gives you access to professionals that you can't find anywhere else. Anyone who runs a small business knows that hiring is easy when you can get that quality candidate. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate from LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours. LinkedIn knows that people like me and other small businesses like Adam or maybe you are wearing so many hats, and you might not have the time or resources to hire. It's not like all of us can have our own HR department. That's why there are over 2.5 million small businesses using LinkedIn for hiring. If you want to give it a shot and post your job for free, go to linkedin.com/sweetspot. That's linkedin.com/sweetspot to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Awesome. Should we get on with some of the questions we've had from Twitter?
Yeah, so we got a lot of great, we love to do listener questions. So we'll get to some of them, probably not all of them. We always love to do Q&A shows here and there. So we'll pick a few and get to them. You have one in particular that you want to tackle first?
Well, in order of the ones I've written down, Michael Riley asked the difference between sim golf and real life. I know it's not always relevant to everybody, but I think that has, even if you've never played sim golf, there are important points from it. And it was a liked comment as well. So it seems like people do want the answer to that. I know I play a little bit more sim golf than you, especially at the moment, right, John? How's your elbow doing?
I don't want to get into it. I don't think I've told you this, but I think my other one's starting to hurt. I'm getting really depressed about it.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry. No, it's not that bad. It's still manageable, but yeah.
Do you think it is the typing that's done it then?
I don't know. I don't know if that guy was right who left that review. Maybe he was writing the book. No, I think it's just been years of hitting golf balls, lifting weights, and all types of other stuff. And eventually your tendons are like, stop.
Well, you're an old man now.
I'll be all right. Yeah, I'm an old man.
the difference between sim golf and real life in terms of how many shots better are you? Obviously, when people first start sim golf, they're worse. Not so much for the long game, but putting is quite difficult to get used to because you're doing it through verbal commands instead. Normally, you see and you use visual information with putting, and now you're having to convert a number in your head to a feel. And that's interesting in itself, is that, yeah, the first time you do that, very difficult, but obviously as you practice it more, you start to get a feel. Like, I know sitting here, what does 20 foot feel like? What does 30 foot feel like? I have those feels locked in. And after that point, you actually get better at putting. I did something where I'm using the Tangent app to track strokes gained, and I can track simulated rounds as well. And so I'm going to get a few more under my belt, but it's interesting to see the difference between real life and sim golf. And my long game is pretty similar on the sim as to real life, but my short game is incredibly different. Putting, I'm gaining like 4 or 5 strokes to scratch, whereas in real life, we all know I'm losing 4 or 5 strokes to scratch, apart from my last round. And short game is obviously easier as well. And I think, you know, those things make sense because you're constantly hitting on the similar lie every time. You're getting perfect contact every time. The outcome is going to be consistent as well. In real life, you can hit a great shot. It lands where you want it to. And then the bounce is unpredictable. And so all these things, I think, for non-sim golfers are still worth taking into account, is that, you know, our expectations when we're playing real life, we got a lot of things that are going against us in real life. You're not always hitting to, you know, sometimes you'll hit to a green and it's a little faster than the last one, or it's a little harder than the last one. Tour setups are obviously much more consistent, but the courses that we're playing on can be a little bit random at times. I know there's sometimes you'll step on a green in real life and you look at it and you're like, this one's been freshly cut. This is going to be faster than the last 5 we've played. And then obviously there's the things like you're constantly hitting off a flat lie. The wind can be removed in sim golf, although they still have it, but it's more predictable. And it accounts for about 6 to 10 shots, most people say, that they are better in sim golf than real life. So that's amazing to think that most players are losing 6 to 10 shots just because they can't adapt to different lies on the course. Maybe course conditions are less favorable or less consistent. What else would make sim golf easier?
Well, I think it's really you also don't have the mental burden of like a round of golf, because as you said earlier, you're not walking for 2 or 3 minutes or riding on the cart in between shots and having to wait for a playing partner after hitting a bad drive. And all of a sudden, like, that's kind of eating at you. So I think the distractions and the mental challenge of quote unquote live golf absolutely contribute more to the higher scores, in addition to all the other stuff you listed, like you're playing off flat lies, you can bounce it off the turf.
You're lined up perfectly every time.
Yeah, you're lined up perfectly. Yeah, like alignment on the course is much harder. Wind, elevation changes. I know that they are on sim golf, but it's just not the same. I would buy that most people are going to shoot significantly lower. Like, I haven't played that much lately, but when I was playing a lot of it, like, yeah, I would shoot 7, 8, 9 under par. Like, I'm not doing that on normal courses. It's just, it's kind of like target practice. When I'm locked in with an iron, I'm going to hit it pretty close to the pin because I'm just kind of going on autopilot. It's not the same as the course. But I've actually found that for me, the putting and the short game was kind of a huge pain in the ass for a long time and still is for me. For whatever reason, like the depth perception, like I got good at the putting where I could, okay, that's a 20 footer, 30 footer, but that's not how I putt in real life. I'm more like instinctual and like absorbing it with my eyes versus saying, oh, this is a 30 footer. Therefore, I will go 1/2 inch past my right foot with the backstroke. Like, I needed to do more of that in sim golf. Like, I don't putt like that in real life. I actually think I'm way better in real life putting than sim golf. And same with like chipping and pitching. Like, I would make some really stupid errors around the green on sim golf sometimes. But I got a little bit better at it as time went on. But I don't love the short game on sim golf is what I'm saying.
One thing I didn't mention is the 6 foot gimmies for the most part.
Yeah, well, that too. It's like,
that helps a lot.
Yeah, you're going to make a few more putts from shorter distances. Yeah, but you would see like some of the tournaments, I haven't played at them in a while, but yeah, there's some guys who are shooting like 18 under every round because they just absolutely know how to make all the putts, and like they're never going to do that in real life.
Yeah, I'm going to actually try and watch some of the top guys and maybe track their strokes gained with the app to see how they're doing that. But yeah, you regularly see in the tournaments like 12, 10 under, sometimes a couple of rounds of 12 under. it's ridiculous. And it actually gives you a handicap, and my handicap on sim is +8, but in real life, I'm closer to a +3, and most of those shots difference are in the short game. It's interesting, but I think there's an important lesson for people is that you can save a lot of strokes on your game just by through the playing skills, things like improving your alignment, improving your putting, your short putting. Yeah, and improving, you know, how your judgment of short shots and things like that can really, and your ability to adapt to different lies, I suppose that's the big one as well, because you're constantly on a flat lie in the sim, and then you get out there and there's different lies, ball above your feet, below your feet, and people can't adapt. So if you were able to adapt, you'd make the difference between your sim and real golf much closer.
It's a nice measure of like your potential.
Yeah, yeah.
If you say like, all right, if you were like kind of firing on all cylinders, like maybe this is how good you could really play on the course, but just be aware that it's not the same.
Yeah. Yeah. What questions do you have?
So one that I got this via email actually, and then there was a separate, I'm going to combine two separate things here. So one was that Padraig Harrington releases a lot of game improvement content. He's quite good at it. He has a very cool YouTube channel. So recently he made I think the Champions Tour quoted him as saying that something like he thinks every golfer can get to a single digit, or he thinks he can help every single golfer get down to a single digit handicap. So I put it on Twitter last night saying like, do you think that every golfer has the chance to be a single digit handicap? And I think 45% said yes and 55% said no. So that's like question one. And then question two I got via email was saying that how long does it take to get really good at golf? And he said really good is between a 0 to 5 handicap. So similar question. He's like, my wife, he's like, I'm an 18 handicap and I've been trying, and my wife got down to like a 2 to a 4 pretty quickly. And he's like, I'm very happy for her, but I'm frustrated as well. And I'm wondering like how long it's going to take me. So I guess this question is like, let's tackle the first one. Like, do you think every golfer has the capability of getting to a single digit handicap, which pretty much means like on a neutral course that you could shoot in the low to mid 80s, like somewhat often?
Yeah, no. And the reason for that would be, I suppose, distance limitations. Some people may have, I suppose it's just too extreme a statement, isn't it? Every golfer. If you said 90% of golfers, then I'd be closer to, I'd say, yes, 90% of golfers are going to have the physical capabilities to shoot scratch. Because how far, as long as you can hit it like 200, not scratch, sorry, within single figures. If you can hit it 200, you're going to be able to get on most par fours and two. Par threes are going to be reachable. So you just have to really keep the ball in play, make sure your short game is all right, and yeah, not reduce the duff shots, the complete disaster shots is the big key.
Yeah, that's how I view, you know, you want to shoot like an 83, 85 a lot. That's a lot of routine bogeys. And if you like, it's removing the oh crap shots around the greens or off the tee. Yeah, the chunks and skulls, which, yeah, I think, again, the question's a bit extreme. Can all golfers get to a single digit? No, I don't think so. I think some people could play as long as they want, and maybe this is a bit pessimistic. Like, there's other stuff, like if we were taking a different skill set and saying like a similar level of achievement, I don't know what a single digit handicap would be in like carpentry, but I'll never achieve it. I just like, like there's certain things that I'm not good at and I don't have inherent natural talent for. I think I do for golf, but I think there's just some people who like, yeah, like they could try as hard as they want, get all the instruction. They might never reach the single digit. I think most people could though. As you said, like 90, like I don't know what the number would be, but like I'd say most people could. That's with the amount of right, perhaps coaching, the amount of time that you need to play. I just don't think most people have that opportunity just because they don't have time, money, and all the other stuff that gets in the way. I think Ben Hogan said that he had a quote once that he thinks that thought that every golfer could shoot in the 70s. And I didn't agree with that. I don't think that's possible for every single golfer. But for most with the right mindset and work ethic, yeah, I think it's possible. That's a bit better than single digits. But yeah, I think most golfers could get to the low 80s.
Work ethic is one thing. I mean, obviously, if you put a ton of practice into something, you're probably going to get good at it. But the biggest catalyst to all of that would be golf intelligence as well. So understanding of certain things. So, you know, say you've got the golfer who goes out there and they start slicing it one day and they use instinct to correct that. Well, what are they going to do? They're going to start swinging more left, because that's what instinct would tell them. Oh, ball's going right. Let's start swinging more left. And they start hitting a pull fade. But now the problem is the low point has gone forward. So then they start hanging on their back foot so they can strike it okay. And then they just, if you don't have the right fixes in place, you can start to develop yourself into a bag of errors that ultimately ruin your potential. So work ethic on it in itself is not going to help you. If you've got the right understanding, then that really is a catalyst for greater improvement. If you can, at the very basic level, understand some impact laws, you know, at the real basic level, what we talk about, the big three, at the more advanced level, if you can understand things like gear effect or why the ball is flying like it's flying, that's just going to help you. The more practice you put in, then that's going to make, it's going to make you better. I think that combination of work ethic or ability to practice and golf intelligence is real powerful.
Yeah. And then the other part of that question from the email I got was, well, how long does it take? And that's impossible to answer. But I would say that, so I'm a big believer, you know, that whole 10,000 hours thing came out for a while and then it kind of got like debunked a bit. No one really knows the answer to this, but like, I still think like the best I've seen is like, it's half genetics and half, you know, environmental stuff for literally anything, like your chance of getting cancer, like how good you can get at something, like our genetics play a huge role. And I've seen people, I'll give you a perfect example. I got to play golf with some ex-athletes and I played golf with Eric Gagne, who for baseball fans, he won the Cy Young Award as a relief pitcher, which was very rare. He was an incredible athlete, like could have played pro hockey, but I think he got hurt. He's Canadian. He had a really good major league career. This guy took up golf when he retired and I played with him. He was already a +5 handicap and had already won a mini tour event within like literally 3 years of taking up golf. And he was driving at 330. Because he's an athletic freak. Like the guy could literally take up anything he wants and he'll figure it out. He is just blessed with size, coordination, whatever. And there's just some people who take quickly to a game like golf because they're just better suited for it. I actually saw there was another NFL athlete. There's an NFL player there who sucked. He was horrible. He was a great defensive lineman in the NFL, could not swing a golf club, was just horrible at it. For whatever reason, like his natural athletic ability did not match up with golf. He probably could play for his whole life. And Charles Barkley is an example I think most people look at. He's still not kind of cracked the code and he loves golf and he was a Hall of Fame basketball player. So I just think certain people are suited for it naturally. And those are the ones that kind of progress quickly and figure it out. Now, for the rest of us, if you do all the other stuff that we constantly talk about on the show, they're like, yeah, I don't think it's crazy for someone to get to single digits. I want to say like 4 to 6 years, something like that. I think, you know, I have a few friends who've done it that quickly without tremendous innate ability and they got some lessons and they played a lot. I don't think it's crazy for someone to do it in 4 to 6 years. It could be quicker than that. It could be longer, but I think if you're like playing enough, you got some lessons and you're learning a lot on the golf course, like, yeah, I think to get to single digits, it's possible within that time frame. That's what's my best guess.
Yeah, I did it in 2 years.
That's how long it took me. Mine was like, as a junior, was like probably 3 years it took me.
Yeah, exactly. I did it in 2 years, but I was a junior. And in the summers, the summer holidays,
yeah, so
I'd spend 12 hours a day at the golf course every single day.
Exactly.
So it's like, yeah, it's tough. But I mean, it's just a mixture of nature and nurture. I mean, two extreme thought experiments would be if you've got 1,000 babies and you gave them all the exact same training, exact same advice.
Is that your new, it's not 100 golfers anymore, it's 1,000 babies. That's your new one.
At the end of 20 years, you're going to have a mix of levels. It would be interesting how many of those would be scratch or single figures. I could imagine every one of those, or vast majority, are going to reach single figures at least, if they're doing the same amount of training, same type of training. But you're going to be some who turn out to be Tiger Woods. And on the other end of the extreme, you could get, like you said, you know, 1,000 athletes who have already great innate athletic ability, and teach them all the same, and they're not all going to come out the same. Or maybe don't teach them all the same, but they get different advice. You know, why is Charles Barkley so bad, or why was he so bad? Well, he probably has a different understanding of the game. Maybe he does have the talent to play the game, but he just had a different understanding, and his swing and everything evolved differently. It's just that mix of nature, nurture, genetics, talent.
The two biggest things for most people is time and money. I constantly talk about people that say, like, oh, I can practice a ton, but I can only play once or twice a month. I'm like, I don't know if that's enough. You need to be spending enough time on the golf course to develop those playing skills and learn and adjust. And that requires, yeah, you got to pay more greens fees, or you got to get lessons. Like, this is an expensive activity. And not everyone has unlimited time and money. So I would think that's like one of the big limiting factors. That, heck, that's even one of the big limiting factors of making it as a pro golfer. You know, if you don't have good financial backing as a mini tour player, you're probably not going to make it, because you just don't have the amount of money it's required to like travel. Like, I've talked to a lot of these players. It's as much about like skill and talent and hard work, but it's a lot about money too. And if you don't have enough money, and a lot of them get like financial backers, or let's say they have a wealthy family, then they have less pressure on them in every tournament. Because some guys and women are like, hey, if I don't make a cut here, I can't go on. I just don't have any money left. So that goes with regular golf too. Like, time and money are a big factor. So I think in a general sense, like, I think most people have the potential, but are they going to do it properly? And then time and money.
Yeah, I think at that level, people don't realize how much the social factors and societal factors take place into whether someone makes it or not. I mean, there's also like developing your game versus maintaining could be very, very different. Like, I can maintain a +2, +3 level of play just going out once every 2 weeks and maybe hitting balls for half an hour. Whereas if I wanted to develop my game, if I wanted to get from +2, +3 to +5, +6, I'm probably going to have to put in 30 hours a week of training and get out on the golf course 2, 3, 4 times a week. And so for me, the payoff is not worth it. It's like people say, sometimes I post the stats and they're like, oh, why don't you try and compete? And I'm like, well, there's a ton of reasons why I don't compete. I'm not good enough. I never will be. But you know, one of them is it's just not worth it. You know, I've got a business that I run and I enjoy doing it. And putting 30 hours a week to play on some local tour, it's just the payoff isn't just not worth it for me. I know you enjoy competition much more than I do, John, but I'm happy to just take the money off my friends each week.
Oh man, I'm like chomping at the bit. I just signed up for all my tournaments.
Oh, really? That's not interesting.
Yeah. Well, also in my book is like, there's different levels you can seek out. So for example, like, you competing against your buddies, that satiates you. Someone like me, maybe I'm a bit crazier. Like, I need a little bit more of a test. All right. I think that takes care of that question. You want to pick the next one?
We are going to take a quick break and we will be right back.
Yeah, this one, I just saw it mentioned and I've seen it several times, but I don't actually know what it means. But what is true scratch?
Oh, this,
I have an idea of what it means.
This means scratch. That I'll tell you what this means. This means that you don't spend a lot of time on Twitter.
All right.
So Jake Weaver asked this question. It's a bit of a long running joke in the golf Twitter community. So allow me to educate you for a second. So most people do not, like, I posted today on Instagram. I always post this every few months. I'm saying, I just need to clear this up for people. Like, your handicap is not your average score. Some people like still think, oh, if your handicap's a 15, that means you average 87 every time you play. It's not. It's a collection of your best scores adjusted for slope rating, course rating, and it weights that. So it's more of a measure of your potential on a neutral course. So whenever someone says they're a scratch golfer on Twitter, the joke comes up. It's like, well, they're not really true Scratch. And they're like, well, what's true Scratch then? And then they like, well, he's got to shoot a 67 on like a 7,200 yard course. And it's like, no, you don't. Let's say you played a 7,200 yard course all the time. Like, let's say your home course was brutally difficult and like the rating was like a 78. You could shoot in the mid to high 70s a lot and have a handicap index of zero. And some people are like, well, that's not true Scratch because they're not shooting in the 60s. And it's like, well, then you don't understand how the handicap system works. So yeah, there's a long running joke. People will say like last week it was the big tournament was at Bay Hill. Really hard. Super, I don't know if you watched any of it.
I played on the sim.
Yeah, it was so you know how hard it
played,
is.
Yeah.
So you know what a mental grind it was.
Yeah.
Rough was lush. And of course, every time the PGA Tour or any pro golf tour plays like one of these crazy hard venues, someone asks, well, what would a scratch golfer shoot? So I wrote that as kind of a joke. My answer was, at my handicap level, if I played that course, I'd be really happy to shoot in the low 80s. You know, they're playing over 7,000 yards. I don't even know what the course rating would have been with that rough. Like, water everywhere, brutally hard. Like, if I shot a 78, I'd be like, wow, that was great. And then, of course, people chime in and are like, well, a true scratch would shoot. So the joke is that I think a lot of people, and I did too for a long time, like, you go back to our episode on scratch golf, we did cover this, but I think some people like idolize or fantasize about what a scratch golfer looks like. And they're really like, they're very good, but they're not firing at pins and making a ton of birdies and shooting five under all the time. Like if they were, then they'd be a plus five. So it's a bit of a joke in the Twitter golf community. It's like, are you scratch or are you true scratch?
Yeah. Well, I mean, your handicap is based on your eight best scores or the average of your eight best scores out of 20. And then it's adjusted for some other things as well. But it's pretty much your eight best scores, I think. Now, I'll push back a little bit, and I will say that you could have two scratch players who are very different.
Absolutely. There's a little bit of truth to it.
Yes. I say I personally don't tend to shoot much higher or lower. So, you know, you could imagine a player who has 20 rounds of golf under their belt, and they're all level par or within three shots either side. And then you could have the other player who's a bit wilder, and their best scores are scratch, but their worst scores are like 90. So their worst scores are much higher, but that doesn't go into the making of the handicap. So you could have two players who are, one's much wilder, one's much more consistent, yet they're the same handicap.
Yeah, I think there's some instances, there's always caveats. So let's say there's a golfer who their home course is like very well suited for them. Like let's say they were really crappy off the tee and they had like a very forgiving course off the tee and they only played that course and they were a zero index. Now, let's say you changed their home course to like a very tree-lined water, like just not a good match for them. Yeah, their handicap could be a four. Handicap system is not perfect. I totally know that. So I would, you know, if you want to say like what's true scratch, my definition would be, yeah, your game travels a bit better. Like I like to pride myself if I look back on my year of like on my gin for like 50, 60, 70 rounds, I'm usually shooting like similar scores on like 20 to 30 different golf courses in competition or not in competition. So I like to fashion myself as true scratch versus, yeah, if you had a golfer who just played the same course and posted most of their rounds there and that course was like really suited for them, like, yeah, they might get beat up a bit on other venues that weren't as good. But you know what I always say? Other people will say like, well, they don't have a game that travels. So my answer to that is, you know what game really travels well? Keeping it in play off the tee and good iron play. That travels well everywhere. You can go to Scotland, you can go to Australia, you can go to Colorado, you can play any course you want. Like that game travels well.
That was my immediate thought, was the two different types of driver, someone who's maybe like myself, short, but very rarely makes a penalty, and then someone who blasts it miles but is often on a different fairway. And if you put them on a tight course, they're going to have different scores.
Yeah, you put them in like Arizona golf or where you're playing.
Yeah.
The ball's going to be in the cacti.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So we know what true scratch is now.
All right. Well, thank you, Jake, as always, for true scratch. I'll give a shout out to Brock as well. That's always a good joke on Twitter.
The other one, one of them, what are the considerations when going for a par five in two?
Always a good question.
Yeah. I think
you want me to go first?
Yeah, yeah. You go.
I think the answer is like to keep it very simple. the best thing I could always refer to is, you know, Mark Brody's book, Every Shot Counts. That table he has of golfers' expected scores from distances around the green. And what he found, whether you're pro, 15 handicap, whatever. And this has been backed up. That book came out a while ago, and now we have, you know, Arcos and ShotScope and all the other data tracking companies. It backs it up. The closer you are to the hole, you're better from 30 yards than you are from 100 yards. I don't care if you're in the rough or the fairway, like your expected score is lower. So the simple answer to the question is that you should always try and get the ball as close to the green as possible with a par five. And then the caveat is without taking excessive risk. And I put a few examples of this in my book, but, you know, let's say you had a fairly wide open par five, and like, let's say you had 250 in, and the farthest you could hit your three wood or whatever your lowest lofted club is let's say like 210, and there's not much trouble up there, I would say hit that club. You know, I used to play like, oh, I'm scared. Let me leave myself 100 yards or 120 yards. Like, that's the wrong play. But if they're, let's say the fairway was pinching at 40 yards and there was water on the left or a bunch of bunkers on the right, if it starts to pinch and you can't clear that trouble, and let's say like laying back to 70 or 80 yards, there's a much wider area with just fairway and rough, then you can lay back a little bit more. So you have to take into account what is in front or surrounding the green and where is the quote unquote big trouble. Is there like deep fescue, water, out of bounds, a bunch of fairway bunkers? Like, I would much rather be 60 yards in the rough than 40 yards in a fairway bunker. So part of it's knowing your own game a little bit too. But yeah, you want to get the ball as close as possible to the green. I think most par fives will allow you to do that. And then you just adjust based on like how far you think you can hit it. Can you clear the water? If you don't think you can clear the water on like 8 out of 10 shots, then lay back. There's plenty of sense in that as well.
Yeah, I look at what's my chance of getting it close? What's my shots lost by laying up? And then the chance of penalties as well. So as an example of that, say you have the option, right? Go for it or lay up to 100 yards. Well, if you lay up to 100 yards and it takes you 3 shots to get it down from there, and then on the other side, if you went for it, and sometimes you're going to hit the green and it takes you 2 shots to get up and down. Sometimes you're going to be around the green and maybe it takes you 2.5 shots to get up and down. Right, so say going for it means that you average about 2.25 shots to get it down. So now we've got the option. We go for it, 2.25 shots to get down, or we lay up and it takes 3 shots to get down. So there's a 0.75, almost a full stroke difference, right? So going in that regard, going for it is definitely, you're going to save 0.75 a shot every time you go for it. However, you then have to weigh that up with what is the cost for going for it. Now, if in a perfect world, you never ever hit a bad shot when laying up, say there's out of bounds up there. Now, every time you hit it out of bounds, it costs you 2 shots, stroke and distance. So you imagine playing that 10 times, right? And every 10 times you play it, one time you hit it out of bounds. So basically 10% of your shots are out of bounds. Effectively, going for it then, you could say cost you 0.2 of a shot. So now, going for it saves you 0.75, but also costs you 0.2. So you just take the difference. So it's about half a shot difference. So in most cases, going for it is going to be better. Now, where would that outweigh or go the other side? Well, if, say, for example, 50% of the time that you go for it, you hit it out of bounds, which would be pretty extreme. 50% you hit it out of bounds, then it is not worth it because you're costing yourself a shot, you know, 0.2 times 50%, times 5, sorry, 5 out of 10. It doesn't outweigh then. So there is some complex math there that you could do. But in general, as a rule of thumb, going for it is better. So go to the rule of thumb.
It really is similar to tee shot strategy. It's like you kind of want to put your foot on the gas pedal because when you want to tap the brakes and lay up to your favorite number, there's no guarantee you're going to hit a good shot there also. So I'd rather screw up closer to the hole than further away from the hole. And the same goes for the next shot. Like, we have a short par 4 at my course, which I think is a great strategic hole. it's only 300 yards, but the layup to like leave yourself 100 yards in is no picnic. There's bunkers, it's sloped. There's no guarantee you're hitting the fairway and giving yourself an easy wedge shot. So I just blast my drive. It's a very tiny green with a steep runoff. The ball can come back to you. I just hit my driver every time because my thinking is, well, there's no guarantee I'm going to hit the fairway if I take out my hybrid off the tee. And if I go in one of those bunkers, then I've got a really hard approach shot to a tough green. So that didn't work. And if I go for it with my driver and I have a tough like pitch shot around the green, I can still give myself one chance to screw up and I'm kind of back to square one with the original scenario. So I'd rather like screw up closer to the hole than further away from the hole. Like that's how I've been thinking about it, is because most of the time I'm, you know, that 20, 30 yard wedge shot around the green is way easier than that even 100 yard wedge shot away. Plus there's no guarantee I'm on the fairway to begin with if I lay it up. So yeah, it's just, I think we just get lured into like the safety shot because it feels more comfortable. But again, you know, whatever club you're hitting for that safety shot is not as straight as you think most of the time.
Yeah. The app that I use, Tangent, it actually calculates all this stuff for you. It knows your shot patterns. It knows the math behind if you hit this club, your predicted score will be this. If you hit that club, your predicted nice. Score will be that. And so it actually makes a suggestion for you. So it's pretty cool. So we've done par 5 in 2. We've done true scratch. You got any other good questions, John?
What's the biggest factor from going 5 handicap to scratch?
Yeah, that's the one I've got as well.
You could go back to our original things. Like, can you hit it far enough, keep it in play, and hit good irons? So there's exceptions. Like, you'd have to really outperform with your putter or your wedges. So you'd have to be, like, really good to make up for a deficiency off the tee or with your irons. And I think that's harder to do for most people. Like to be an exceptional wedge player around the greens or a great, great, great putter where you're like gaining a tremendous amount of strokes, I think that the returns on time are diminishing, where like most people have a big growth potential with tee shots and approach shots. But yeah, I mean, the formula's not, it's simple, but it's not easy. Like you need to, we did our episode on scratch golf. Like, yeah, you need to probably drive it 240 minimum, keep it in play, and then hit a ton of greens. That's how I did it, and that's how most people do it. Or you need to be exceptional inside 100 yards to overcome that. But it's a lot of it's going to come from ball striking. You just can't avoid it.
Yeah, I read the question as biggest factor going from 5 to scratch. So these are already pretty good players.
That's a tough leap to make.
It is, yeah. And everybody's going to do it in different ways, because you could be a 5 who's great at driving and sucks at putting, and you could be the complete opposite. You have to look at where you personally are losing your shots, you know, whether it's through mental or technical fault. So really, you just got to keep tracking, like when you miss a shot, when you fall outside of an acceptable range. And I would, as a rule of thumb, say you should be keeping the ball at least within 20 yards of your desired yardage. So, you know, if you're trying to hit 150, somewhere between 140 and 160, if you're falling outside of that range, there's a reason why, and you have to track why. And that could be, all right, it was a poor strike. Was it fat or thin? Was it toe or heel? Or it could be something like club selection, or maybe you pured it, but you just didn't judge the wind. So those are more mental faults. Same for direction. You know, if you're 10 yards left or right from 150 yards, that's okay. It's a pretty decent shot. It might not hit the green every time, but it's still a pretty decent shot. If you fall outside of that range, you have to ask why. Was it, again, just a closed face? Even then, digging into things like, did you overcorrect? If I miss one left, that might have been partly my fault. I might have been trying to hit it more left because the last one I blasted way right and I've just overcorrected. So understanding yourself, understanding what faults are occurring and maybe even why they're occurring. Did you go left because you misjudged the wind? You didn't play enough for the lie? Or was it just a fault that occurred from nowhere? Those are all different ways that you then go off and fix those things. Once you find out where you're losing your shots, now you have this data that can say, right, I'm losing my shots from this, therefore I need to go off and practice to improve that specific area. And then you just constantly end up in that process, and that's how you get down. And that process may look different for everybody.
the best thing is to be analytical and go through the stats and all that good stuff. But we have the Chasing Scratch guys on, you know, once a year, and I spent some time with them a couple of years ago watching them play. You can just see the difference. Like at that point, they're at that like 4 or 5 handicap level. I remember I was playing around with Eli, and Eli just like blasts the ball. This guy's hitting it like 320, 330. And I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, if I could hit it this far, like it was crazy. But I remember one hole, it was a par 5 and plenty of room. You know, he blasted his drive. He kept it in play. Very clear path to the green. And I think he had a longer iron in his hand. And he just launched this thing like 60 yards to the right and I think hit a house or a car. And I'm not trying to pick on Eli, but we talk about face control a lot. Like a scratch golfer is just not going to hit that shot. That's the difference, is like that, oh crap, how did I just blast that 4-iron like 70 yards to the right OB? That is the difference. Like a scratch player, like their worst outcome there would have been like, oh, I kept it around the green. I didn't get it on, but I'm still in play here. I'm probably going to make par at worst. A lot of it's, you know, it comes down to, we go over the big three a lot, but the tolerance is just tightened quite a bit. And it's hard. Like I was stuck at like between a 1-3 handicap for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years before I started to break through. Like it's very hard to get through that last level. You got to take a deeper look and see where your biggest gains can be. Because that's usually where it's going to happen, not somewhere where you're already proficient. Like you're not going to become like that much better at a strength.
Yeah, I mean, analysis is key there, knowing your data, because you can waste a lot of time if you're doing the wrong things. For example, you know, I could say, all right, well, I suck at putting at the moment, and then I could go off and practice in the house rolling balls towards a 10-foot putt. But that's a waste of time for me, because I know that the reason I miss putts is green reading. My speed control is fine. My ability, if you stick me on a putting mat, I'll just roll them endlessly in. So it's not my technique that's the issue. I mean, see, when I post it, everybody says, oh, you need to get one of those lab putters. I'm like, does lab putting help with your green reading? So yeah, you know, identifying when you drill down to what area of your game you suck at, you still have to drill down even further and say, well, which area of the area, you know, in putting is going to be green reading, speed control, or technique, you know, starting it online. So yeah, understanding these things allows you to put your time in the right place. Because I've seen so many players who are working on their putting and they're doing it with some kind of plane board or something like that, working on drilling technique. And you think, you're missing it because your speed control sucks. You roll one a little too fast and it goes through the break, and then you roll it a little too slow. And so you don't need to do that plane board. You need to go off and do some random practice instead from different lies, different areas all the time. Tracking these things is important. Should we cut it there, John? We got an hour. It's a nice place to cut it, unless you got another question you want to...
We had both made an agreement where we were going to keep this episode a little shorter than our usual one. So we're going to cap it there. We have more questions to get to. We will get to them at a later date. I don't know when it will be, but Twitter, thankfully, archives these forever. So we'll hang on to this thread and we'll get back to more of these questions. I can say that the new book is available for purchase. I'll give another plug. Right now, the best thing you could do if you want to buy it is just go on Amazon, choose your format. Like I said, the audiobook will be available probably not till the summer, would be my guess. You don't have to buy it, but I'd appreciate it. I think it'll help your golf game, even if you don't compete. And leave a review on Amazon. That really helps me out. Adam, do you have any... My closing thoughts was my sales pitch. That was my closing thoughts for today.
Yeah, I don't have any closing thoughts. Just like I said, track stuff. Yeah, just on that last point. So yeah, I mean, if you find in your tracking that you suffer with long and short, then get the strike plan, adamyoungolf.com. And if you suffer more with left and rights, then get the accuracy plan, adamyoungolf.com. If you're wondering what app I'm using to track my strokes gained and stats, and it even has the ability to track certain faults such as strike issues, it's called Tangent. And it's currently only available for Apple devices, but if you use code AYGOLF30, you'll get a free trial and 30% off if you wish to continue. So that's code AYGOLF30, and the app's called Tangent.
Very nice. Well, thanks for everyone. Thanks for your consideration of the foundations of winning golf. Again, not to belabor the sales thing, but we really do appreciate everyone's support. Like, you literally keep this thing going. You keep our businesses going. Like, everyone who listens to this show is part of a community, whether you know it or not. And we're very proud of this community. We're very thankful for it. So yeah, thank you everyone who's been reaching out, asking about the new book and all that stuff. People reach out to Adam, they get lessons from him. People reach out to me. It is awesome. And it's all possible because of you. So with that, thank you for all the feedback and the questions. Keep them coming and we will create more content around it. And we'll see you next time with the new episode.
I bid you adieu.
He bids you adieu.